I really want to make a podcast. People? Well, we've got a huge opportunity to share with you. StoryHive is giving away 10 grants of $10,000 each to aspiring podcasters in BC and Alberta. Since 2013, TELUS StoryHive has funded and supported emerging creators with mentorship and guidance from the National Screen Institute, bringing hundreds of creative Western Canadian projects to life. This time, they're taken to the airwaves with their inaugural podcast edition, dropping on November 4th. StoryHive is looking for original nonfiction podcast concept pitches from BC and Alberta residents. Make sure you apply before December 2nd at storyhive.com and you could get $10,000 to get your podcast off the ground. That's storyhive.com for all the details.
Old or New Testament?
I think the New Testament.
The question is, Pilate. Remember Pilate from the New Testament?
What's this Pilate? He fiddled while...
Just a minute. Let me ask the question, then you can give me the answer, okay? Did Pilate want Jesus to be crucified?
Pontius Pilate washed his hands of it.
So did he want him to be crucified?
Yeah.
No. No. No.
Well, tune in every Friday afternoon, 3:30 to the Night Watch Show on Sunya!
Well, find a good church. It'll help you.
You reminded me about what the most important thing in life is. Do you know what I think it is? Friends.
Here at CITR, friends are really important to us, and when you become a member at CITR, our friends are your friends. So join CITR today and get discounts at The Australian Boot Company, Devil May Wear, East Vanity Parlor, The Bike Kitchen, Virtuous Pie UBC, and Save On Meats. And those are but a few. For more information and a complete list, visit citr.ca/friends.
Keen to repeat a lazy remark.
Okay, so I don't know why I did like an elf voice.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Hey friends, this is Monica, and you're listening to the All Access Pass on CITR 101.9 FM. I hope you're all keeping well. We have a terrific show lined up for you today about accessibility in the arts, specifically in classical music. This is our first time airing a show about this topic, so we hope you enjoy it. But before we start, our fellow collective member, Randy, will be introducing our first piece. Randy, please take it away.
Thanks, Monica. Hi, everyone. Here is the Bach Double by Adrian Antoine, and we're actually going to be speaking with him later in this episode, so please stay tuned.
Thank you.
Welcome back to All Access Pass on CITR 101.9 FM. The piece you just heard was the Bach Double by Adrian Antoine. To know more about Adrian, please stay tuned. We're going to speak with him later in this show.
Thanks so much, Randy. Now let's go to our show topic, which is how classical music can be accessible. So growing up in Canada, I know a lot of us have learned about classical music related topics in schools. For example, learning the recorder in elementary school and perhaps joining band or youth orchestra in high school. But we should stop and think, how accessible is classical music and how are artists advocating for people with disabilities in classical music and the arts? To get things started, here's Richard to talk about classical pianist Nicholas McCarthy. Richard, please take it away.
Thanks, Monica. Nicholas McCarthy is a British classical pianist, and he was born in 1989 without his right hand and only began to play the piano at the late age of 14, after being inspired by hearing a friend play Beethoven's Waldstein Sonata. Having once been told that he would never succeed as a concert pianist, Nicholas was not discouraged and went on to study at the prestigious Royal College of Music in London. His graduation in July of 2012 drew press headlines around the world, as he was the only one-handed pianist to graduate from the Royal College of Music in its 130-year history. In March 2018, he was awarded honorary membership by its president, Charles, who is also known as the Prince of Wales. McCarthy is a champion of the dynamic and brave world of something called left-hand-alone repertoire, a repertoire that first came into being in the early 19th century and developed rapidly following the First World War as a result of the many injuries suffered on the battlefield. Nicholas has performed extensively throughout the UK and internationally, and typically performs in about 50 concerts a year around the world, most recently conducting a six-city tour of China. However, he says that there have been plenty of hurdles. Aside from having to put in more effort than others to learn advanced left-hand repertoires, McCarthy says that being judged by his disability instead of his playing ability has sometimes been discouraging. Despite that, he has performed around the world and even playing at the closing ceremony of the 2012 London Paralympic Games. But he says it took him more than 2 years to be accepted in the classical music industry. There are people's judgments in the classical music world that you can only play the piano if you have two hands, he says. It was hard for me because I had to convince them that I was worth listening to. I was bucking the trends, but my passion for the music and my perseverance have carried me through.
Thanks, Richard. That was a very fascinating report about Nicholas McCarthy. So recently, Sarah, Evan, Richard, and I had a great opportunity to have a virtual sit-down with a one-handed violinist, educator, and disability advocate, Adrian Anantawan. Adrian is a distinguished violinist with many accolades, having studied at prestigious music institutions such as the Curtis Institute of Music and performed at the White House, Olympics, and the United Nations. He has done tremendous work in music education and disability advocacy, which he speaks about in the interview. So without further ado, I would like to introduce Adrian Anantawan.
So Adrian, I'm super, super happy we get to have you here. We really appreciate it and we're really excited to interview you. Are there any important terms or words that we might want to avoid when describing you, and how should we address you? And in other words, how would you like to identify you? And if you have any inclusive terms that you'd want us to call you by.
Thank you. That's very thoughtful. I think that you can. My name is Adrian, and I use he, him, his pronouns. I have a limb difference in my right arm. And I think that's all I can think about for now.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Adrian. All right. So let's get into our questions then. So who is Adrian Anantawan?
That's a very interesting question. I'm trying not to refer to myself in the third person as well. I am a musician. I am a disability advocate, an educator, and hopefully I always strive to be a person who uses my gifts and privileges in order to serve others and create a greater degree of access, equity, and inclusion specifically within classical music.
That's great. And I think you do that a lot through your teaching and through other projects, right?
Yes. So I'm very lucky at this point in life, at least, to have a lot of different hats or balls to juggle, whichever metaphor you want to use. And they all sort of center around, as I was just saying before, that centralized identity of creating access and inclusion. So as an educator, I teach in the K-12 environment. I've done public charter schools down here in Boston, leading arts programs. I currently chair a department at a independent school here. And I also run a nonprofit that serve students with and without disabilities after school to be able to play music together. And I also continue to play music whenever I can, which is something that is still very core to my identity and something that I feel like is a wonderful fuel to be able to continue doing a lot of the difficult, challenging work in education and disability advocacy in particular.
That's awesome. Thanks for telling us that. So since we're I haven't personally been to Ontario, so we were kind of wondering what was it like being raised in Mississauga, Ontario?
So I arrived to Mississauga when I was around 6 years old. I was born in Ottawa, spent a few years there, and then my parents wanted me to be closer to Toronto because there was a hospital there called Holland Bloorview Kids Rehab Center that made my prosthetics and various other adaptations in order for me to have a full life. And just having appointments closer to the center was going to be important. So we actually moved to Etobicoke first, and then around the age of 6, 7-ish, I moved to Mississauga afterwards and really just stayed there until I began college. It was wonderful to be able to have a community, to be able to learn about the arts and music and to participate in the youth orchestra. I was part of an organization called the Chamber Players of Mississauga, where I made a lot of my friends, some of them I know to this day. And it was definitely a great access port to the big city in Toronto, and to be able to think of different ways that I was working, for instance, with the Toronto Symphony, or doing various projects with the theaters that were downtown. So a lot of opportunities as a result, and people don't know that Mississauga is quite a diverse and very large city. I believe it's still the fourth largest city in Canada, at least. I'd like to almost say North America, but it's large and definitely a lot of room to do some amazing work in classical music, at least.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. Yeah, I totally didn't know Mississauga was that large, too. I guess it kind of gets overshadowed maybe by Toronto and things like that. But yeah, that's awesome that you have got that many opportunities. And speaking of opportunities, what inspired you to get into music and specifically classical music? And in other words, what drove you to become a professional violinist?
So I was 10 years old when our fifth grade teacher all wanted us to play a musical instrument. And she took out the recorder and thought that it was the most accessible instrument because it was easy to learn, it was inexpensive. And yet when I looked at the amount of holes in the recorder, like I realized I didn't have enough fingers to be able to actually play. So my parents started looking at different options. I think one of them was the trumpet because you could actually hold it with one hand, but I didn't identify with the sound. It felt a little bit loud to me, to be honest. I tried a little bit singing. That didn't really fit. And it wasn't until I saw a recording of a violinist named Ishak Perlman, who grew up with polio but became a master violinist. He was actually on Sesame Street. That's how I saw him for the first time, struggling to get up the stage with his crutches. And yet when he held the violin, he was a master at what he did, and whatever his challenges were trying to get up to the stage had disappeared, and the context had completely changed. And just that representation as a young person was very powerful to me. So I told my parents that this is the instrument that I wanted to play without really thinking about the practicalities of it. I thought it was a very beautiful instrument. And yet at the same time, I think that my ignorance of like how challenging it was going to be to make the adaptation was actually a benefit, because I was just a kid who wanted to try something new, which spurred on some innovation from Holland Bloorview. They created a device where I could hold the bow quite simply, actually. We call it a spatula. And just from the very beginning, having a supportive community from teachers to those prosthetists to being in an orchestra, making friends through that, where it wasn't how I looked, but really how I sounded on the instrument. These were all profoundly important aspects to my identity that I was only lucky enough to be able to pursue it as a professional. I think that somehow I was blessed with having certain gifts, like being able to hear if something was in tune or out of tune, very good body kinesthetic sense, and then just the good work ethic, I think, because violin in particular is an instrument that is extremely difficult to start. There are no frets, for instance, like on a guitar. You really do have to repeat things over and over again in a way that is very unique to at least this particular instrument. And yet I was able to do that and go to college. And I think at that point, I was also very lucky to start finding some recognition through what I was doing, because it was different. There aren't a lot of one-handed violinists in the world. And that allowed me to continue this work and to propel it to where I am today.
Thank you so much for telling us that. That's honestly really inspiring. I totally understand. Like, I know the violin's reputation for like how difficult it is. Like, I used to play the piano, and yeah, I remember seeing my friend the violin. I'm like, oh my god, this is like, you have to like get everything right, and the frets, and even you gotta deal with the bow as well, and all that stuff. But I totally agree with you. It's a really beautiful, beautiful instrument.
I do have a question. So generally, I know the violin is played with one hand. Like, I think generally the left hand, right, is playing on the fingerboard, and then the bow is on the right. So did you have to flip that or adjust that at all, or was that, did that work okay for you?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there weren't any modifications to the violin alone. I think that the significant amount of modifications happened on the bow end. Sorry. On the bow end of things. And I have met violinists, however, who are missing their left hand, and they will need to reverse the strings and do everything flipped. Luckily, the violin is a very symmetrical instrument, so if you flip the strings and the bridge, it still works out. And it's a pretty easy modification to make for a violin repair person, so long as they understand why it's happening.
Cool. That's really cool. Yeah.
The next question is, was it difficult finding teachers around you, especially with overcoming different obstacles? Was there a challenge to find teachers at a young age?
So I think it's very interesting when we talk about the definition of a teacher. I think there are formal teachers that you have in school. And then for me, at least, I had a formal violin teacher who was very inspiring and really taught me that in music, the most important appendages that you have are not your hands, she would say, but your ears, because you have to listen to the music. You have to understand what's beautiful to you and then figure out how to replicate that or even produce your own version of what beautiful is with your body, and you're the expert in understanding what that is through feel and how you change as you grow older. So I was very lucky in that sense to have a very open teacher who really let me experiment and develop my own technique, and was much more of a facilitator in helping me grow rather than just telling me what to do all the time, because she couldn't say anything because she didn't know how it was to grow up or play without a hand, essentially. Mm-hmm. I think there were other informal teachers, however, like, as I was saying, my friends who would just like teach me like a little song during like an orchestra break. Teachers as in like listening to recordings, and like I listened to the radio all the time, and that was a great teacher. Parents, of course, who really instilled not necessarily musical skills, but habits of mind, of discipline, and being okay with mistakes, and still providing whatever support I needed, even if something didn't sound perfect right away. I remember when I was preparing for auditions, playing for my mom, and she'd be lying in her bed. It was like probably 8 o'clock at night, and I would play for, I don't know, probably about 5-7 minutes, because it wasn't a long audition. And I would do that every single day for like several months. And I just imagine now, looking back at it, how patient she must have been if she was probably trying to watch the evening news and just hearing a scratchy violin instead. So aspects of that were tremendous in terms of, like, you know, just being in the same room can be a teaching or educative environment. And as we know, sometimes we just need people to be present and listen to us. And somehow that teaches something about ourselves as we just reflect what we're giving, and maybe, you know, having it come back to us in a different way.
Right. I just have a follow-up. You mentioned a lot about adaptivity and I guess your workflow, and especially I could see it in your approach to learning when you started out, how you have adapted the people around you and the teachers around you and made it work for you, which is really inspiring. I'm just curious, have you taken any of these lessons from your own learning journey into the educational side of your life? You work with children, right? And I'm very interested in seeing how that has transferred into that side of you.
Yeah, so as I was mentioning before, I am always inspired by those who really listened deeply and were present. When I was a student, and I think that is so diverse in how we listen, especially when we talk about kids who have various forms of disabilities and might express in different ways. Right. I work with students, for instance, who are nonverbal or are communicating more with their behaviors than their actual words. And always asking myself the question that when kids are in our presence, they're always communicating something, even if they're completely still. Mm-hmm. And it's really up to us to be in this curious and investigative mindset of who they are. Mm-hmm. Because children don't need to be spoon-fed answers, especially in the arts, because the ultimate answers are just really who they are as people. And then we give them skills to be able to express that through a musical instrument, through their voice, through practice techniques. But the core of what they do and how they will be impactful, they're already experts at, in a sense that, like, no one knows them better than themselves. Right. So giving kids in particular the freedom to make mistakes and to know that they are still valued as complete humans is very core to the work that I do. I would say that, of course, there's technique in teaching and how you structure lessons and classes, but you can, just like in music, have the best technique, but if you don't have the heart and the soul sort of in the music, it's similar in teaching. You don't remember that teacher as well. So I always try to reflect after I work with a child, like, did I show them that I care about them, essentially? Even if I'm hard on them or you know, in a space where, you know, we have to be in a place of discomfort, because learning is a challenge as well. Just to continually reflect with that, because sometimes I think I do well in that, and sometimes I need to improve as well. And part of good teaching is having that humility to continually improve and to, just like as a performer, try to be the best possible version of yourself at all times.
I'm just very, very moved by your passion for teaching and how you've applied just the things that have affected you the most and that you've carried all this time. It's just very, very, very nice to hear.
Yeah, especially, I mean, there's so much thought into an end goal of what a child's trying to achieve right now. There's no space for like attentiveness, or patience, or like that moment. So probably is a nice reprieve for them. What are the highest and lowest points of your career? I know you mentioned that you were able to get some auditions, and you haven't mentioned, because you're very humble, that you got, I think, several scholarships. But did you have any notable low points? Or
I would say that I've been very fortunate in terms of like my musician career to be where I am today. I think that the lowest points or the largest challenges have always been like trying to fit in with like an orchestra, for instance, especially within like a professional context. So I do a lot of work as a soloist now, and generally it's sort of nice because I can walk on stage and I can do whatever I want, and an orchestra will have to follow me because I'm the soloist sort of deal, which is a little bit inflating, of course, for the ego. But when I was auditioning for orchestras early on, before I really knew where I really wanted to go with my life, I would do these auditions for like orchestras, and they would do it behind a curtain so that people didn't see you, and that was supposed to remove bias if you're like someone who identified as a woman or a male. It was just supposed to create a greater degree of equality or non-bias in the process. And yet at the same time, what I did, because I used my bow so differently, I had a very unique sound. And in an orchestra, that's not as important as like being able to match and blend with your orchestra mates. So I did have a struggle early on where I would just go around and do auditions and never really get past the first round of callbacks. And I realized that even though I really loved orchestra and wanted to be sort of in this position, that maybe this was not my destiny to like be part of this larger group and to be in that blend. And in retrospect, I'm grateful that that lesson was taught to me early. And yet at the time, it felt like, what am I going to do? Because this is a very viable, important pathway for a lot of violinists in particular to be able to have a career, and to not have access to that was definitely a disconcerting moment of my life before I really made that pivot into education advocacy and continue to play as a soloist.
Welcome back to the show. We'll have more of the interview with Adrian Antoine in just a bit, but let's go to our second piece. I thought it would be fitting to include some pieces from Richard's report, So here is the cello suite by Nicholas McCarthy off the album Echoes. Welcome back to All Access Pass on CITR 101.9 FM. The piece you just heard was the cello suite by Nicholas McCarthy off the album Echoes. And here is Monica.
Thanks, Randy. Now let's get back to our show topic, which is classical music and accessibility. With this, here's more of the interview with Adrian Anantawan. Adrian has played many venues around the world, and we were just wondering what was the most memorable performance and venue you've ever played?
I would say the White House or the Olympics, one or the other. I actually did play in Vancouver for one of the opening ceremonies, and I remember never thinking that starting off as like a young 10-year-old who could only play Twinkle, that I'd be on this stage where I could see tens of thousands of people with their cell phone lights on and look like just playing to the universe, essentially, at that point. And to be part of history and to be able to know that my music was contributing to something that had an impact on a lot of people, not only in Canada, but the world, was an honor for sure. And then in terms of like being at the White House, it was just really cool to meet the president and like to see all the memorabilia and to be in the green room and like have like M&Ms that had like the presidential seal, just a lot of like cool, fun stuff. Again, sort of moments where I wouldn't have imagined that where I started, that these would be just aspects of opportunities that would be presented to me specifically through music and the arts, because I think there are so many folks who achieve just as much in other fields, but just the public nature of what we do has really reminded me how lucky I am to have had these unique experiences.
Yeah, it sounds like playing for people all around the world for such an international audience is really a crazy and fantastic experience. So we were also wondering if you had any favorite pieces that you enjoy playing or any favorite composers, and if you could share those with us.
So for violinists, if you're looking to see what the essence of violin is, the Bach sonatas and partitas are focal point in the journey of most classical musicians composed around the 1690s. It's a collection of six works by Johann Sebastian Bach, who really pushed the limits of the instrument, at least in the time that he was composing. A lot of the times, the violin is treated as a melodic instrument, and you're only playing one line at a time. The amazing thing about these pieces is Bach essentially creates four-part harmony, like almost like piano or organ music, for the violin, which is, again, like only supposed to be playing one line. So it's the type of work that, like, a lot of students... Sorry. It's the type of work that a lot of students start off with when they're sort of developing as musicians, and we play the rest of our lives, because the works are almost orchestral in nature. You notice different textures, different instruments that you might be trying to imitate from one line to the next, and they really serve as a mirror, as I play them at least, every single time, of who I am as a person, where I am physically, emotionally, and definitely something I come back to on a regular basis.
Well, that's really fantastic. I think Bach is also one of my favorite composers as well, so that's really awesome to hear that his music is such a great impact on you. We were also wondering, have you played any other instruments? And if so, what were they?
I've dabbled on the piano, and I can get around okay, but not on any professional level. I play the viola, but that's also a very close cousin of the violin, so that's almost like cheating. I would like to play a little bit more cello, but I think I need a different adaptation that might be a little bit longer to hold the bow. But I think in principle, like I could probably do it. And the Bach cello suites are classics. Like, I'm a big fan of Yo-Yo Ma, and I've always wanted to play that one that he's very famous for, the C major, first movement prelude from the first suite. So I would say that would be my first choice. And then from there, it's like, that's enough in the end. It's like exploring one instrument and four strings has been a lifetime and will continue to be like that. And I can't imagine like any other type of activity or tools that like you can spend that amount of time with and like just like still try to figure it out sort of deal.
I just have a question about the Holland Bloorview Kids Rehabilitation Hospital. I think after hearing a little bit about your history of the center and its role within, I guess, your childhood, can you tell me a little bit about the Virtual Chamber Music Initiative? I'm very interested in your work with it.
Yeah, so I started this initiative, which is a combination of classical music, technology, disability, and performance. And really just gathering experts from every field to be able to collaborate and find ways for folks who have different types of disabilities than my own, for instance, to make music with regularly abled peers. It's amazing to see technology, especially these days, that's exponential in terms of advancement. And sometimes I feel like the technology that we have in our pockets or even on a laptop, for instance, can be dehumanizing. It's always better in person, especially now that we've experienced this collective challenge of COVID. Mm. So the Virtual Music Initiative is really aimed at leveraging technology to humanize, and specifically this tool, the virtual music instrument, otherwise known as the VMI, translates gestures into musical sounds and uses a webcam on a computer device or tablet. And say, for instance, a child is only able to move their head because they're paralyzed or immobile from the neck down, they can still make music by head tilts or gestures to hit various notes in a virtual space. So the possibilities of thinking that no matter where you're at, even if you're only able to like move or tilt your head like to one side, that you can communicate and express yourself, but also contribute to something that's larger than yourself and to make the world a more beautiful place. This is something that the initiative has continued to expound and promote for kids to this day. And as we continue to develop advances in technology, we're always on the lookout to see how we can leverage these tools in an environment to help kids learn and perform music.
So I think music and music performance itself finds a lot of power in the performance space, right? What are some things that you have found while recreating this in a virtual context and that expression within music? What are some ways like you guys have adapted to the VMI to that?
So I think that the VMI is one adaptation, and interestingly, it's the environment around the person who has the challenge or disability to adapt around them. Mm. I think sometimes we put the onus on the person with the disability to do all the changes and like, let's fit in so that everyone else is comfortable. Mm. And I think that I'm always a huge proponent of like, yes, this tool exists and we're going to work around it. If there are some limitations that the virtual music environment, or sorry, virtual music instrument has in this environment, let's change the environment sort of deal, which means different types of pedagogy, curriculum. It could mean more accessible space, could mean just more people who are trained in special needs education. It could mean just a wide variety of factors that sort of create an enabling environment. And some will need less support and some will need more, but it's really, again, listening to that student or performer and seeing where they're at and doing everything in our power to make sure that the mindset is, if this person succeeds, we all succeed as well.
Mm. Wow. So has this has the VMI been implemented anywhere else besides just in the Ontario area? Has it found its place everywhere else?
It has. I think the VMI is used in a lot of music therapy contexts. The technology, at least when it first has started, is now relatively old. It's about a decade old, and in technology times, that's like 1,000 years ago.
Right.
So a lot of newer technology has been out there, and there are updates to the virtual music instrument that are made from time to time, but I'm excited over the even just the past couple weeks testing out new programs that are coming out of Holland Bloorview to see if they will actually work with the kids that we serve, and really going in with that innovative mindset to put people and technology, materials, attitudes in the same room and just see what happens.
Mm. That's awesome. I wish maybe I could, you know, get an experience with the VMI. It seems like a very powerful instrument. You completed your master's in education at Harvard in 2011. And I was just wondering, have you always been interested in teaching and more specifically working with children?
So yes, education was always a passion of mine. I started informally as a teacher when I was in college still and just mentoring younger students who were in the same school. Mm. And I think that it was always something that I realized was a calling, but I didn't really listen to it until much later in life because it almost seemed like there was a predestined path for me to become a musician only. And as I was saying, I was blessed with a ton of opportunities to be able to showcase my work. So it took a little bit of time to really just accept that music performance wasn't the only thing that would make me happy or complete. And And I am very grateful now to be in a place where I'm able to realize all of these identities together, but it takes time, and it takes a lot of searching. I think that young people think that straight out of college, they know exactly what they're going to do. And for me, it took 15 years at least. And now I'm in a good spot, but all that struggle and sort of building up, it just requires patience and listening to yourself.
So having worked alongside many musicians across the country, what is something that you have taken from your experiences and brought to the classroom? And maybe vice versa, was there anything working with children that you've brought within the performance practice?
So for teaching, especially if I'm like in front of a classroom, it's like a performance in the end. It's like you have a lot of dress rehearsals and meetings so that when the curtain reveals, you're always on your A game for these children who are ready to learn. I think it is something that, especially as we've emerged out of the pandemic, how amazing of an experience it is to be in the same room as young people and to have this space in which we are attending to our future. And that amount of care and preparation that you put into every single note in a musical performance is exactly the same as when we're teaching in a classroom and really finding a continual cycle of getting better and better. In terms of the other side, I think that I don't take things as seriously now when I'm on stage if I make a mistake, because I realize that my students are also learning and that we're all here to just have an experience when we're sharing music together. Yes, there will be tiny flaws, but if you wanted to have no mistakes in your performances, then we would just record all the time, edit, and just make sure everything's just the way that we want it.
Right.
Or we get robots to do our jobs, but then you lose something else on that too. So I think just like seeing kids like and knowing that their mistakes contribute to their learning has allowed me on stage to be more accepting of those same mistakes or challenges too.
And has that affected, I guess, your review of your performance now? Like, do you feel happier after it? Are you more at peace when you finish? Or
yeah, I think I live more in the moment when I'm performing, and I can enjoy myself, and I'm just more grateful as well.
Right.
I think that people think that if you allow yourself to make mistakes, that you won't have the discipline to sort of attain mastery, but ironically, it's the opposite. If you can't allow yourself to make mistakes, you can't take risks either and express something that may have never been expressed before.
Wow, that was really powerful. Sorry.
Yeah, this is insanely relatable for people in our 20s, I think.
Great.
Yeah. I just want to talk a little bit more about your scholastic life. You pioneered representation of disability within the artistic space. Being the first artist of a limb difference at scholastic establishments like the Curtis Institute of Music and the Yale School of Music. My question is, what are some challenges that you found during those times? And what are some ways you believe you can empower the next generation following in your footsteps in those spaces?
I think that music education, again, sort of defines excellence in very narrow parameters. I was very lucky to squeeze in because I sort of conformed, as I was saying, to certain standards that people found convenient in a way. And I don't take that for granted. I'm very grateful for these opportunities. And at the same time, I know that people who have, as I said, equally important voices who might just come from a different disability background or express art in a different way might not have had the same access to the opportunities that I've had. So I think that having a more open mindset for schools is going to be important, especially within classical music, where we struggle with this balance between innovation and preservation. Mm-hmm. And sometimes if we're thinking too much about honoring the past, which is very important, we don't really see where the future is. And I've always encouraged music schools, at least classical music schools in particular, to celebrate the innovations and disruption that have happened throughout history, rather than saying that this is like sacred now and can't be changed. Mm-hmm. And to realize throughout history that the art that sticks and we live to this day, or that we have to live with to this day, are works or composers that might not have been appreciated in their times. Like mm-hmm. Beethoven, for instance, no one liked his music at all. And they thought it was noisy, chaotic, and it's only now that now it's like he's the old guy. But if he were alive today, he would have been pushing ahead and really dismantling structures as much as we need to do as well. It's uncomfortable work. And at the same time, it's a work that is founded upon our hope for the future, to know that even if we are not understood within the times where we are creating this discomfort, that we are doing this for something that is maybe beyond our lifetimes, maybe for a different generation. And that's a mentality that I hope not only pervades education in general, but a lot of the pressing current social issues that we face in our world.
Wow, that's really beautiful. So as this well-spoken and really well-delivered advocate for disability and the arts, where can we expect to hear from you soon? Are there any upcoming keynotes or any projects we should look out for?
Yeah, I do a lot of stuff. I'm trying to think of like anything in particular that's up in Canada. I generally have some projects here and there. I think as concerts begin to open up again, mm-hmm. It'll be nice to be able to travel a little bit more. I think traveling has been the biggest challenge at this point. So I'm playing mostly in the United States at the moment and trying to escape all these quarantining situations internationally, at least. But there are a lot of different roles that I have. So I also am the artistic director of an organization here in Boston that delivers concerts to homeless shelters and places where folks are recovering from substance misuse. And we have a YouTube channel that we have been doing virtual deliveries to the shelters in Boston in particular. So that's a place where I just did a recording last night, sorry. Wow. And that'll be up in a couple days on my own YouTube channel. Especially during the pandemic, I was doing a lot of like recordings from my own home. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing a few speeches and keynotes around the states from like music educator networks and various schools across the country, essentially. So definitely a lot to juggle, as I was saying, but mm-hmm. I always feel like if I'm tired and sort of like just super busy all the time, it just means that I've had the opportunity and the blessing to be able to contribute as much as possible in the very brief time that we have on this earth. So I'm always grateful and tired. Wow. Though.
Wow. That's really, really cool. That's amazing how you find all this time and as all this effort you put into this passion of yours is really, really admirable. I think we just have a last couple questions. Do you have any advice for budding musicians with disabilities?
I think that it's so important, and I know it's cliche, but just to recognize what your individual voice is as inherently powerful, that disability doesn't mean that you don't fit in, but you have a perspective that is something that we can all learn from, and to recognize that what the world needs is essentially who you are, and to put all your energy and time and discipline towards enhancing your skills to be more direct and more focused in what that expression might be is important. Knowing that you're never there to prove yourself, you're already complete as a human, and that it's all about sharing and having the world sort of conform around you, as I was saying, because that is something that you deserve as an artist. So I know that a lot of supports are in place for people to get to where we might be, where we can play an instrument and contribute as a musician or artist with disabilities. But people that are around you can only take you so far. It's really the relationship that you have with yourself that always needs to be nurtured and will draw people in, not only audiences, but people who want to help too.
Wow. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Adrian and Antoine. It has been amazing just to hear about your life story, about everything that has led you to this point and your amazing, illustrious creative career. It's been amazing spending time with you, and I thank you so much for your time. You can check him out on his YouTube and his website. We'll be linking it on the website, and make sure you keep up with him for sure. He's definitely one person to keep on your minds. Thank you.
Thank you, Adrian.
Welcome back to the show. Here is a beautiful piece by Nicholas McCarthy off of his album called Solo, and this is Journey. piece you just heard was Journey by Nicholas McCarthy. And special thanks to my collective members, Avery, for selecting all of these beautiful pieces of music for today's show. Back to you, Monica.
Thanks, Randy. Now let's get back to our show topic, where we're talking about classical music and accessibility. And there you have it, a very insightful look into how classical music can be accessible. I would like to sincerely thank Adrian for coming on the show. It was a pleasure. And that wraps up our episode for today. Hope you all enjoyed it.
If you're interested in joining our team or think there is an issue we should bring up on our show, please send us email at accessibilitycollective@citr.ca. That's accessibilitycollective@citr.ca.
Please like our All Access Pass Facebook page.
If you're on Twitter or Instagram or both, please follow us at @access_CITR.
If you missed part of our live show today and want to listen again, or maybe you want to listen to our past shows, you can do so on CITR.ca by going to the search box and typing in All Access Pass.
Thank you for listening. Stick around for more CITR programming coming up next. Bye, everyone.